Iran says it has over 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium and will maintain its self-reliance on supplying Tehran's research reactor with fuel. China accuses Taiwan of inciting confrontation and distorting facts after Taipei said it will continue to bolster its military capabilities in the face of Beijing's pressure. And scuffles break out between Tunisian police and protesters demonstrating against President Kais Saied's seizure of power. Appreciate you being with us. Well, the first story takes us right here to Iran this hour, where Iran has criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for failing to condemn an act of sabotage against its Karaj nuclear site on June the 23rd. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said the IAEA, with its silence, effectively encouraged this type of terror attack. He added that the agency was not allowed to replace damaged cameras as required under the Iran nuclear deal because the U.S. and the Europeans did not comply with their obligations. Islami noted that Iran will not tolerate the IAEA's double standards. He also stressed that Iran is pushing ahead with its civilian nuclear program, adding that the country has now more than 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium. He said Iran will maintain its self-sufficiency in supplying Tehran's research reactor with fuel. And it's time for this hour's news review. Vote counting is underway in Iraq as polling stations close in the country's parliamentary elections. Preliminary results are expected on Monday. Nearly 25 million people were eligible to cast their ballots. Around 3,500 candidates competed to enter the 329-seat parliament. Candidates include around 1,000 women. Now, the election was the fifth parliamentary vote in Iraq since former dictator Saddam Hussein was ousted in 2003. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, called for a large voter turnout. Security has been tightened with all airports closed until Monday morning nationwide. Now, voters said that they hoped the elections would bring about a change.
Today, we came to participate in the elections, my family and I, so that we ask for our demands, the population's demand to have early elections. God willing, our participation in the elections is a new path for Iraq, with new faces that we choose, so that we continue to have ambitions for change.
Prime Minister Mostafa al-Khatami and resistance leader Qais al-Khazali cast their ballots in Baghdad. This year's election was held under a new electoral law that divides Iraq into 83 constituencies instead of 18. Now, that's meant to help independent candidates. The vote came a year earlier than scheduled in response to protests that broke out in 2019. Now, those protests called for better public services and an end to corruption and economic woes. Iraqi elections are often followed by months of negotiations over a president, a prime minister, and a cabinet. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review out of Baghdad, Wissam Bahrouni, and out of Brussels, journalist and political analyst Elijah McNear. Thank you both for being with us. Well, Wissam, let's start off with you. Tell us the latest, because we understand that the polls are closed. Do you have any kind of preliminary results? Tell me what you have.
Yeah, as you say, the polls closed here in Iraq. And what they're doing now is they're using the electronic system, the machinery that they've brought in for this election for the first time in Iraq. Their data goes directly to the High Election Commission. But apart from that, for this constituency, the candidates that had run just in this constituency, remember, which after the legislation that was passed, candidates can only run in one election region So if Baghdad is divided into, say, 17 or 19 regions, electoral constituencies, then the candidates could only run at one of them and not at two different election constituencies. So what they're doing now is a member or representative of each party, or a member for the independent candidates as well, because we've got many independent candidates have run. They're taking a copy of the printed printout that this new polling machinery, and they're going to take it back to their party headquarters, just so that the parties and the independent candidates can be rest assured that whatever results, and this is not just from this polling station, from every polling station, they're repeating the same measures. Taking a copy of whatever the machinery behind me, the electronic machinery printed, a member of each party goes to every booth, collects his paper, and takes it back to the party headquarters or to the candidate that had served. We're expecting the results, preliminary results, I should emphasize. That's going to give us an idea of the turnout and who is among the winners and who are among the losers. But just for this polling station alone, I should add that I spoke to the officials here who say that the turnout here, just at this polling station in Baghdad, was between 20 and 25%.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Wissam. Elijah, in your perspective, tell us the significance of this election.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
The significance of this election are the challenges that the new prime minister is going to face. But before that, we need to see if the results are accepted by all parties. And secondly, are the consultation among the biggest parties, particularly the Shia, who represent the majority of the country, if they're going to reach an agreement among themselves, and who holds the majority of the votes. Now, the real challenges in front of the Prime Minister is the security and the counterterrorism, to make sure that the economic situation can be dealt with, the rebuilding the infrastructure, but above all, the withdrawal of the U.S. combat forces from Iraq. And then he needs to balance the relationship between Iran and the U.S. on the Iraqi soil, and to establish good relationship between Baghdad and all the neighboring countries. So there are quite serious and huge challenges for the prime minister. There needs to be a strong prime minister, and that can happen only if Saeed Muqtada Sadr, who is expected to win the majority of the seats, or perhaps win the largest number of the seats, wins and then manages to form a coalition and appoint a prime minister with the acceptance of all the other groups that accept that the prime minister will be a Sadrist, then a strong prime minister can impose all this very heavy agenda. Otherwise, electing a weak prime minister, we back to square one, and the same situation in Iraq will be hanging around with the presence of the U.S. forces, with the problems of the economy, et cetera.
Well, Sam, your assessment of what Elijah just said, I mean, you're on the ground there, you've been talking to the Iraqi people for a while now. What are their expectations from this election?
The expectation varies from, you know, depending on who you speak to. You have one side that says, we need these vital services that Elijah alluded to, such as, you know, infrastructure, better hospitals, rebuilding hospital services, rebuilding the economy, boosting the employment levels among the youth, which make up the large majority of Iraq's population. And on the other side, you have another argument that says, well, we can do that, and we're trying to do that, but at the same time, the country is under occupation. the American Air Force air fighter warplanes use Iraqi airspace without permission from the government, for example. Iraqi American forces come in and out. So the country's under occupation, as well as you have Daesh sleeper cells. And the officials here link the two, you know, the American occupation of Iraq and the terrorism that Iraq has gone through. They say that they accuse the Americans of playing a part. That's what the analysts say, in that terrorism. So there's that side of the argument says, well, let's deal with that first. That's more important, bringing security to the country, and then we can take care of everything. But the first and the biggest priority and the most important aspect is bringing security, mm-hmm. and that means the removal of U.S. forces.
Elijah, what about that? Of course, the infrastructure is basic, it's very important, but without security in the country, it is very difficult to do anything. And also, when you're under occupation, does any of this really have any meaning? Because at the end of the day, it appears that the Americans can do whatever they want to do, more or less there, until and unless they are taken out or they leave the region. Your take.
This is a very important question. Now, there were talks between the Prime Minister of Iraq, say, Mustafa al-Kazemi, and the American President Joe Biden in Washington, where the Americans promised to withdraw all combat forces from Iraq. Now, there is no trust in what the Americans are saying, because above all, they should not have combat forces in Iraq. They should have forces that support the Iraqi forces. Now, as they confess that they have combat forces, they have the intention to pull out these forces, we have to wait and see by the 31st of December if they're going to fulfill their promise. Secondly, there are the Iraqi resistance groups that are hassling the Americans in their bases and the logistic convoys, just in a way to remind the Americans that they are not welcome in this country, that the parliament asked them to leave, and the government should abide by the parliament's decision and force the U.S. forces to leave. Now, the Americans are aware of that. However, the country is under a very heavy critical financial situation and is lacking around $80 billion. The Americans control the selling of oil, the Iraqi selling of oil, and they control the flow of money in the country, where they can bring other regional countries to support Iraq, or they can impose sanctions. Now, this dilemma with the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister can't take such a decision unless he has a very strong party behind him. A Prime Minister like Mustafa al-Kazemi, who has no political party behind, can't take these big decisions and accept that maybe the Americans will impose sanctions on Iraq if they force the U.S. complete departure. Now, on the other hand, the population is asking for job opportunities. There are already 3.5 million jobs in the government and the security forces, burdening the deficit, and that is also another Iraqi dilemma. And the last one is ISIS and the heavy war against ISIS that left wide destruction in the country that need to be reconstructed, and the money is lacking. So there are so many challenges. By the departure of the U.S. forces, that will be a very big first step. And second, I think the Iraqis can rebuild the country with the support of neighboring country willing to see stability in West Asia.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this news review with Sam Bahrani in Baghdad. And Elijah Mahnier, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. China has accused Taiwan of inciting confrontation and distorting facts as tensions escalate over the island's push for independence. The Chinese Office for Taiwan Affairs said the island is closing the door to dialogue by seeking independence. The reaction was in response to comments made by Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen. She said the self-ruled island will continue to bolster its military capabilities in the face of what she called Beijing's pressure.
We will not act rashly, but there should be absolutely no illusions that the Taiwanese people will bow to pressure. We will continue to bolster our national defense and demonstrate our determination to defend ourselves in order to ensure that nobody can force Taiwan to take the path China has laid out for us. Because the path that China has laid out offers neither a free and democratic way of life for Taiwan, nor sovereignty for our 23 million people.
Taiwan considers itself a sovereign state, but Beijing views the island as a breakaway province and maintains sovereignty over it under the One China policy. Taiwan's growing military reliance on the U.S. has further fueled the territory's tensions with China. Tunisian police have scuffled with protesters opposing President Kais Saied's seizure of power. Scuffles broke out in the capital, Tunis, as police tried to break up the demonstrators. Protesters called on President Saied to step down. They carried banners reading, "The Constitution is a red line." Last month, Saied brushed aside much of the Constitution, giving himself power to rule by decree. His move came 2 months after he sacked the prime minister, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority. Well, opponents have accused Saied of staging a coup. However, the president insists that he aims to address Tunisia's political paralysis and economic crisis. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Aperture.
What
Welcome back to Aperture. Before we follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rue plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country, and their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world, and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Esfandiar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and a very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Esfandiar, that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a schoolteacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Isfandiyar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning, and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold, and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Isfandiyar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain. But there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems, but Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
perhaps next time you enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Isfandiar and the kind and hardworking farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In mid-June, the port city of Prince Rupert in northern British Columbia was the scene of a success by an anti-Israeli movement. A group of activists called Block the Boat formed a picket line to prevent the Israeli Zimvolans ship from docking. The port workers respected the picket line, and the ship remained unloaded for a day and a half before an emergency court order was issued. A few days later, Dubai Ports World, which handles the specific terminal in Prince Rupert Port, where the Volans had docked, announced that it would suspend the port workers for 3 days for respecting the anti-Israeli picket. The Emirati company overtly backed the Israeli shipping company in the face of a growing pro-Palestinian movement on Canadian soil. Yet there seems to be more stories behind the UAE-Israel-Canada triangle. CBC News has recently revealed that Canada's former Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, heads the advisory committee of AWZ Ventures, a Canadian-based firm focused on Israeli cybersecurity and intelligence technologies.
These technologies that we're discussing are being tested on Palestinians. The Israeli military tests on Palestinians, and that's why Israel's been at cutting edge of all kinds of security intelligence technologies. And two, the Canadian company is going to sell those to the different monarchies, particularly UAE, but probably also Saudi Arabia, to repress their own population. So Canadian company is with the former prime minister is going to make money from a mix of repression of Palestinians and repression of those living in the different monarchies in the Middle East.
According to the CBC expose, AWZ Ventures finances Israeli surveillance technology systems, including facial recognition and crowd detection systems, and services that deliver comprehensive information on individuals in real time.
Stephen Harper, the prime minister, the former prime minister, who's the head of the advisory council of the company, he was an extremely anti-Palestinian political leader in this country. He's considered to have really shifted Canadian policy in support of Israel in a quite strong way, voting against all the UN resolutions upholding Palestinian rights, deepening military ties between Canada and Israel, justifying all of Israel's destruction of Gaza in 2014, on and on and on. Canada has a long history of being quite supportive of Zionism, but Stephen Harper really deepened that support, and I think that this Harper's role in AWZ Ventures is really just extending that kind of position.
The alarming point in the report is that the firm is involved in facilitating the purchase of these double-edged technologies to the United Arab Emirates, a rich Persian Gulf country with one of the poorest human rights records in the world. In addition to Stephen Harper, AWZ Ventures has former Mossad, CIA, and MI6 senior members on its advisory board.
I think it's definitely a cause for concern regarding, I mean, this is Canada, every year, Canadian military companies, Canadian government, with Canadian government supporting it, attend a big arms fair. In Abu Dhabi, and I think this is sort of extending this process along, where Canadian companies are providing tools for repression.
What's more, the Canadian-based firm is setting up a new subsidiary in the UAE, under the name of AWZ Horizons. It said the company will be run by Catherine Verrier-Fretchet, who used to be the representative of Canada to the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. While the UAE's easy access to surveillance technologies is disturbing enough, opening a new subsidiary in the country would be really dangerous, as it seeks promoting and facilitating this Israeli technology to other despotic regimes in the region, such as Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. And this is all against what Ottawa claims to be neutrality in its foreign policy, using former diplomats in the cybersecurity business to pave the way for interactions with oppressive regimes is anything but neutrality.
The fact that a former Canadian representative to the Palestinian Authority, Catherine Verrier-Fréchette, the fact that she is part of this endeavor in the UAE and spearheading it as the in-country representative in the UAE, that's quite interesting. I think that speaks to her politics and the fact that one element of this relationship between the Canadian company, Israeli Mossad and IDF officials and the UAE is that this is tied to the broader geopolitics going on, where Israel and the UAE are obviously, you know, began diplomatic relations, and there's a whole process of trying to sort of normalize relations with Israel. And this venture, I think, is one, you know, a small little piece in that overarching sort of geopolitical dynamic.
Among other Canadian figures who work for AWZ Ventures are Richard Fadden, former director of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and Stockwell Day, former Conservative cabinet minister, who can whitewash these regimes whenever the occasion arises. For example, in one case, Fadden said, "A lot of the technology is useful in fighting terrorism, and that was my main interest. Some of the technology that's been developed helps develop a sense of what's going on the one level on social media, so you can accumulate information." This per se shows that the Canadians are prepared to go to any lengths to work as apologists, both for Israeli products and for despotic clients such as the Arab kings and emirs in the Persian Gulf and beyond. After all, these Arab regimes are notoriously known for using state-of-the-art technologies to suppress any freedom-seeking movement in the region, not for fighting terrorism. The role of Israeli spyware Pegasus in the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi has now been factually proved by the same spyware the UAE has targeted many dissidents and journalists at home and abroad.
The UAE is a place that has, you know, some of the least amount of public participation in political life. So it's quite a repressive country, and it will be used. The technologies will be used to deepen that repression. Also, you know, regionally, the UAE is has been heavily involved in war in Yemen, in Libya, in Syria. So the UAE is you know, strengthening the monarchy's you know, repressive intelligence military capacities is also, I think, you know, troubling in terms of from a regional dynamic, because it's a quite belligerent place.
Ironically, even these apologists themselves don't come from a country with an immaculate human rights record. The recent discovery of unmarked graves belonging to indigenous students in Canada is just a case in point. Now, the Abraham Accord, or the confluence of money and technology, facilitated by Western powers such as Canada, is threatening the whole region. And the presence of Israel in Expo Dubai this year for the first time is just marking a new era that can go sinister anytime.
Yes, sir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.